This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. It is on. There are just 5 days to go until the preliminary election for Boston mayor. Early voting, though, underway. And tonight, WBUR and Radio Boston will join other co-hosts to bring you the last candidate debate before Election Day on Tuesday. So let's build those debate bingo cards for tonight. We'll review the candidate positions and we'll sort of, well, check the score on this unprecedented race. Joining us now, WBUR senior political correspondent Anthony Brooks and Megan Irons, reporter at the Boston Globe, who has been covering the race. Anthony, thanks for joining us.
Hey, always a pleasure. Hi, Tiziana.
Hey, Megan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
All right.
Happy to be here.
Folks, let's do this. Anthony, we'll start with you. Give us a quick snapshot of the race and where it stands right now.
Okay, well, just to bring people up to date really quickly, five candidates: acting mayor Kim Janey, city councilors Andrea Campbell, Michelle Wu, Anissa Saibi George, and John Barros, the former financial chief for the city of Boston. They are all in this race. And recent polls suggest that Wu has pulled out in front with a substantial race. But there is a contest for a second spot, and that could be close. Now, that said, there are a couple of wild cards. The latest poll suggests lots of people are still making up their minds, so we don't know where they're going to go. And we don't really know what effect early voting, which you mentioned, will have. Will that increase voter turnout substantially? And if so, that changes the dynamic somewhat. So there's some wild cards, but that's the basic shape of the race.
So then, Megan, there's some debating going on. We mentioned we'll co-host the final debate tonight. WBUR is doing that with The Globe, WCVB Channel 5, and the John W. McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. But there was a televised debate last night with the five candidates as well, sort of a, we'll call it a warm-up. Let me ask you, what stood out to you from last night?
Well, I think it was very interesting to see all the candidates together last night. In many ways, it was the first opportunity for voters across the city to see the candidates up close. This campaign has been going on all year. And for the most part, the meetings have been virtual. There have been more than 60 forums, and most of the candidates have attended those, and a few in-person meetups. So this was an opportunity to see the candidates side by side, talking about the issues, criticizing the acting mayor, who took a lot of the heat, and laying out their vision for what they see for the city. I think for the first time, people were able to see a person like John Barros basically taking on the acting mayor and see the acting mayor fielding criticisms from some of the people that Anthony just talked about, who are competing with her for the second place, Andrea Campbell and Anissa Saibi George, who are critiquing her on a variety of things, including housing and including the debacle that we have seen this morning on children getting to school this morning and not being able to be picked up. There's just really horrifying stories of kids waiting at the bus stop, unable to get a ride, and parents using Uber to send their kids to school. And so tonight, we're going to see the mayor, acting mayor, back from that warm-up. We're going to see how she responds to even more criticism, I presume, from today's debacle. And I think the candidates, having gone through this warm-up, are going to be ready tonight.
And I do want to note, a little later in the show, we'll have WBUR education reporter Carrie Young, who's going to talk a little bit about the school buses this morning and the start of the school day in general. Anthony, it's kind of my experience. Sometimes it's like we all saw the same debate, and sometimes it's like a Rorschach test. So let me also ask you, what are your reflections? What did you see last night?
Well, I thought Megan summed it up really well, but I guess I was struck, and I'll steal a line from the way the Globe characterized it. It was very genteel. I mean, it could have been a lot rougher. There was a lot of substance on policing, on housing, on schools, but I doubt if it made or sort of broke any of the candidates or changed the basic dynamic. If anything, it probably helped Wu. She's the front runner. Nobody ganged up on her. That said, and Megan mentioned this, some of the candidates took shots at acting mayor Kim Janey, and I think that sort of points to both the benefits and the perils of being the acting mayor. I mean, she's had a lot of weeks of being able to hold press conferences and get lots of attention and sort of say again and again, I'm the mayor. But on the downside for her, she's the focus of the criticism. And as Megan said, there were big problems around school buses. And there was a bit of a tussle between Barros and Janey on crime in the city that I thought was interesting. Janey cited statistics that crime is down this year. It is quite low. But Barros pounced on her. Here's a bit of that exchange.
This issue is real. I live with the trauma, as do many residents across our city. And my plan has been working, but we've got to do more.
I'm not sure what Mayor Janey's plan is. I'd love for her to point to a plan. She doesn't have a plan. Check her website out. Said that she was going
to
do a plan.
My summer
She is quoting data on work that the Walsh administration did.
So I'd expect probably to hear a little more of that kind of criticism of the acting mayor tonight as well, in tonight's debate as well.
And worth noting that John Barros was a part of the Walsh administration as we listen to that sound there. So, Megan, there's the horse race and there's the policy. On the horse race side, if we believe the polls, Michelle Wu has a strong sort of outside the margin of error lead. And it appears, a lot can happen, that there's kind of a race for second. Do you have any sense coming out of last night who is in the best position to grab that second spot if Wu is, in fact, the top vote getter?
Well, I think that's one of the most exciting part of this covering this election is you just don't know, right? All of the candidates that are competing for a second spot based on the polls all have very, very good strong points. I just want to get back to something about Michelle Wu. Yes, she played it very low-key last night. She basically stayed out of the fray. She almost seemed like a non-factor, and I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but something that people observing the candidates might be taking note of. I thought Andrea Campbell, she has been very critical of the acting mayor and remained so last night, picking apart some of her plans, calling what's happening with the schools unacceptable. And I think her assertiveness in this race has helped her to advance from the earlier polls that were taken in June until now. And I think if she continues to beat that drum, if she continues to be critical of the mayor, you might see her numbers increase. I think Anissa Asabi George is in a league on her own. She's in her own lane, the only candidate that's calling for increasing the number of police officers on the force, very pro-police, and some would say very old Boston. And so I don't think anybody's competing with her for those voters. But I don't have an answer for you in terms of who is going to break out.
You can't
of
tell me
pack.
5 days before the election who's going to...
Megan, I'm just glad you didn't ask me that question because I wouldn't have had an answer either.
It's a tough one. And as Anthony said, there are people still making up their minds. There are people who love two of these candidates, three of them, and they're still trying to figure out, okay, should I vote for Andrea? She might have an edge. Or should I vote for Kim Janey, who might actually keep the job? So this is really, really, it's going to be down to the wire, I think, for a lot of people across the city.
So, Anthony, I want to pick up on some reporting you did this morning, because you've also been looking at sort of the race for endorsements and how that influences maybe the, 8% or so of undecided voters. What can you tell us?
Yeah, or not. Yeah, I mean, well, I was just out on the campaign trail yesterday just looking at what was going on. And one of the things about endorsements, it gives these candidates sort of an excuse to sort of go out and hold an event. So Michelle Wu has the backing of Senator Elizabeth Warren, for example, of Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins, among others. And yesterday she picked up the endorsement of State Representative Aaron Michaelwitz. He's chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, powerful guy on Beacon Hill. He represents neighborhoods like the North End, where he was yesterday. And he threw his weight behind her. Here's a bit of what he said.
So So whether it's fighting for accessible and affordable housing, putting forward a comprehensive plan for climate resiliency, or a long overdue development reform, Michelle Wu is the candidate that Boston needs.
And there are other big endorsements. You know, City Councilor Andrea Campbell got a big plug from the Boston Globe's editorial board, which picked her as the best candidate on education, affordability, public safety. This week, John Santiago, who dropped out of the race in July, endorsed Janey. Janey, of course, was also endorsed by this movement called Wakanda 2, which is an effort by the city's black community to coalesce the black vote behind the mayor. And Asaibe George, as Megan mentioned, has been endorsed by police and fire unions, including former police commissioner William Gross, you know, which helps shore up her reputation as the more moderate candidate. So, you know, that's a snapshot of where some of the big endorsements are.
So, Megan, jump in. Nope, I'm going to you.
I was going to say, I mean, there's a big debate about whether how well these endorsements play out with folks. I mean, do they really mean anything? And I think it's going to come down to who has the best get out the vote operation and who can convince these 8%ers who are still on the fence. And I think this election is a standard election despite its historic nature. And so turnout is going to be regular as they would in any other municipal election in a mayoral year. And so this is going to not be decided on who's endorsing who, but it's going to be decided on who can bring their voters out in droves to the polls to vote and get those early votes in early. And that's going to be the test of both of all three candidates vying for second right now.
So, Anthony, before we turn to tonight, just very briefly, any candidate that particularly stands to gain from either high turnout or low turnout?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, the sort of conventional thinking is a low turnout election is going to favor a sort of more conservative candidate because the folks who are coming to the polls are sort of the usual voters. So the thinking is that Asaibe George would benefit from a low turnout election. When you've got lots of new people coming to the polls, then, you know, the city is ready for change. You know, think of Ayanna Pressley's remarkable campaign and upsetting Michael Capuano. She got lots of new people out to the polls. That meant change. That meant a change candidate.
So, Megan, I'm going to come to you. I love building that debate bingo card. So looking ahead to tonight, obviously I won't be playing bingo because I'll be moderating. Nonetheless.
Good luck.
Thank you. With your colleague, by the way, Adrian Walker, what should some of the messages be? What do people need to get across tonight? What needs to be on those cards?
Well, I think for Kim Janey, she has to demonstrate that she has a plan to continue to lead Boston through November 2nd. And she has to convince people who are kind of doubting her right now. The poll that we had earlier showed that people thought she's doing a great job as mayor, but that has not translated into whether or not they want her to continue to lead the city. So she has to show, you know, through her performance tonight that she is the person to lead. Michelle Wu has to also show that she can lead the city as well. And I think there's a lot of the polls show that there's a lot of newcomers to Boston, higher educated people who really like her message. And I think she's comfortable right now if you're banking on the polls. The other candidates have a little bit of fight on their hands. Andrea Campbell needs to claw her way out of that fourth spot. And Anissa Asaibe George has to tick off Kim Janey. So they both have a challenge on their hands. And John Barrows has to come out there as he did today. I think on all the analysis that I've seen so far, he definitely did his job last night. Last night, he's getting a lot of play. And maybe that would be the spoiler in this race going forward.
All right, Anthony, so in our last minute or so, what are you going to watch for over the next few days?
Well, I mean, I think it'll just be really, I mean, the debate is key. I'm really looking forward to watching that debate tonight. I agree with everything Megan said. I expect it to be sort of similar to last night's debate, with Wu, the apparent front runner, kind of, holding that position and not trying to shake things up too much, and that kind of aggressive scramble for second place. But like Megan said, I mean, the key for the next few days is going to be getting out the vote. It's going to be what kind of advertising we're seeing, what kind of online advertising, and that's going to favor the top three candidates who have the most money in the bank, which is Kim Janey, Andrea Campbell, and Michelle Wu. They all have about $1.5 million. Asaibi George is right up there as well. So it'll just be really interesting to see how they get their voters motivated and out to the polls, because that's how you win elections.
All right. Well,
the more people that vote, the better.
Captain Obvious. But it's such an important point. I'm glad you closed with that, Anthony. WBUR senior political correspondent Anthony Brooks, Megan Irons, reporter at the Boston Globe. That was fun, you two. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Take care.
Kids are back in public schools today in the Boston public schools as COVID worries continue, and five major mayoral candidates try to distinguish themselves on who is best for kids and for schools. So now school buses have emerged at the center of that fight after BPS started warning families last week that their child's bus might not show up this morning. At a televised debate last night, acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey sought to assure parents that the city had reached a contract extension with the bus drivers union that had her, quote, encouraged about bus coverage today. So how did it go? And how did the day go in general? WBUR education reporter Carrie Young was at a Boston school bus stop at 6:45 this morning. Joins us now. Carrie, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, as always.
All right, let's start with those buses, Carrie. Was acting Mayor Kim Janey's optimism founded?
Yeah, I mean, the buses did run this morning, although there were some delays to report. Quite a few, actually, at the bus stop that I was at today. However, I did just get some data from the district that shows that they did better than years past when it comes to dropping the kids off on time. That's the on-time performance, as they say. So this year, it was about 57% of buses that got to schools on time. And the five-year average, apparently, according to the district, is about 48%. So some improvement there today.
So what bus stop did you visit, Carrie, and what did you hear from parents while you were there?
Yeah, I headed over to Dorchester this morning and hung out with a lot of people at a very big bus stop around Geneva Avenue and Westville Street. I talked to a crossing guard first just to see how things were going. She didn't want to be recorded, but she did say that she watched a lot of families this morning wait for a pretty long time. One of them was Shahrazad Powell and her son. The bus that he was supposed to get on heading to Brighton today was supposed to arrive at 6:30 this morning. And by the time I caught up with her, it was already 45 minutes late.
It's extremely frustrating only because when you have other children, I had to actually have like a friend of mine make sure my other son got to school. And then I have two other children that was like had to get dragged out of bed at like 5:00 in the morning.
So the bus did end up arriving at around 7:30 this morning. It's not like it didn't come, but it was about an hour late altogether. I will say, though, you know, while a lot of people were frustrated about the wait time, a lot of people were also mostly excited about going back to school, and you could feel that among the students, too, like fifth grader Zariah Simmons.
I'm excited and nervous because there are going to be some maybe new people in my class.
Yeah, and she also, you know, mentioned to me that she was just excited to meet new people and learn new things. Her mom shared those sentiments, and she said that, you know, she was generally excited to see both of her kids go back into the school buildings full time. She is worried about COVID. She said that's always been on her mind, but for now, she just told me, like, she's mostly just trusting that her kids are going to do the right thing with masking and sanitizing, and that the district is going to keep its COVID safety promises, too.
And briefly, do we know anything else about how the day unfolded? Did it go okay?
As far as I know, district-wide, there haven't been any like major systemic issues. But, you know, a lot of schools, depending on when it started, a lot are still just letting out. So we'll keep watching.
So I did want to ask you about a virtual parent protest earlier this week that was aimed at the Department of Early and Secondary Education. It was from parents who were concerned that the state's elimination of a virtual learning option puts kids at risk. Can you tell us what the parents want?
So this group of parents is a group of parents in Boston. They organized this because a lot of them have kids with very complex and fragile medical conditions. I spoke with one of the members again today, actually, Bethany Van Delft Maffey. She has a daughter who has some developmental delays, and she also has a history of really severe respiratory illnesses. So she says that the stakes feel really high for her family right now. In fact, she actually decided to keep her daughter out of school today because the school told her that they can't guarantee that she won't be in contact with unmasked people.
We don't see a safe way to send her in. We're begging the school and the district to give us options to keep her safe. If they won't give us a remote option, we're begging for options to keep her body safe at school. They're turning down those options.
Now, Van Delft and others do technically have options to stay out of physical classrooms. One of those is homeschooling. That's always been an option. Another option that's been around for a while is the two virtual schools that are here in the state. But parents in this group say that those aren't good options for them either. And so what they are demanding from the district is that their individual schools offer a remote option. Because if they were to choose homeschooling or the other virtual schools, that would mean unenrolling their kids from the current school that they're in, which in Boston is a really big deal because the district uses a partial lottery system when it comes to school assignments. So if you unenroll, that means you lose your seat in a place that you and your child may really love. And officials with BPS say their hands are really tied in this situation, mostly because of a state policy that, you know, almost completely takes virtual learning off the table for districts. Only 7 districts were allowed to have a virtual option this fall, but even then, those programs have to be considered as their own schools. So it's not extending that physical classroom into the remote environment like these parents want. So it's a tough situation.
So, Carrie, what's the one thing you'll keep your eye on most closely over the next week or so?
Ooh, I would have to say I would like to, you know, see what happens with COVID transmission rates. You know, more people are going to be in close contact now with each other. So we'll be keeping an eye on those in the next week or two for sure.
All right. We will continue to check in with you too. WBUR education reporter Carrie Young. Thanks, Carrie.
You're welcome.
Okay. So we have firmly established that school is back underway. So we have a word problem for you. New teacher stress plus will I fit in? Plus pandemic anxiety plus tough year of learning last year equals big challenges for kids and families. There will undoubtedly be a heavy focus on the core subjects this year, including math. And helping kids through that can be complicated by the fact that kids learn math now in a way often unrecognizable to their parents. So, are our kids ready for the big 5 subjects, including math this year? How do you help them? What questions do you have or techniques have you developed? And do the stakes feel higher this year, given where we are in the pandemic? Call us. Join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. We have 2 guests with us today who say that teachers, parents, and kids can work together to take on tough subjects, catch kids back up to speed, and help them thrive in the classroom. Hillary Kreisberg is director of the Center of Mathematical Achievement at Lesley University, and Matthew Beyrenavand, the mathematics coordinator for Chelmsford Public Schools. They are authors most recently of the book Partnering with Parents in Elementary School Math. Hillary and Matthew, welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be back. Thank you.
It's great to have you back. And I noticed, by the way, you tweeting earlier, it was almost 2 years ago exactly that we had you on before.
2 years ago tomorrow.
Amazing. And so what a 2 years. Let's start there. What a 2 years, Hillary. What are you expecting from classroom learning in this very unusual year? Will it be business as usual or is it going to be harder?
I think it's going to be a mixture of both. I think we have to give ourselves grace. We are in the middle of a pandemic. And at the same time, I think we need to move forward as well and continue the learning.
And Matthew, is there, I pause, this almost sounds like I'm asking the same question, but I'm not. What is the education imperative this year? Is it get every piece of this year's content delivered to the kids? Is it catch up from last year? Is it support social emotional learning? What is the imperative this year in the classroom?
So first of all, I do believe the social and emotional well-being of the students has to be the top priority. But second really is focusing on grade level instruction. We know that there has been interrupted learning over the last year, but we cannot be pausing and saying, well, we're in a fifth grade class, but we really need to move back to third grade to see what you've missed. So it's a difficult challenge for teachers to be able to do this year, as well as partners, but we believe that it can be done and done well.
So Hillary, I want to pick up on this partner word. The two of you write for parents and educators. Is there a partnership between parents and educators? Is that what it is?
There has to be a partnership between parents and educators. Otherwise, our students can't succeed. So yes, there is a partnership. Has the partnership been visible in every school district? No. And so that's where we have been itching to support parents and also support teachers and leaders in how to create that team effort.
So I do want to ask listeners, was today first day of school for you or sometime in the last couple of weeks for your kids? Are you thinking about your partnership with educators this year? What do you want from it? What do you want to bring to it? What questions do you have? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Matthew, I remember the last time the two of you were here, I felt like the two of you presented teachers as in the driver's seat and parents as sort of offering an assist, if I can mix metaphors, in this partnership. I also know, though, you wrote your most recent book after thinking hard about how the pandemic affected the parent-teacher relationship. So has your thinking about that partnership changed? What's new or different now?
Well, based upon the research that we have done, especially during this COVID-19, we found that parents often feel intimidated, frustrated, worried, and confused about their child's learning. And ultimately, what they're looking for from their partnership within the schools is they want to be a support mechanism to feel helpful, intelligent, confident, and familiar. And it's on both parties to forge that relationship so parents can be playing an active role and schools and districts share what the parents can be doing to support their children, especially in mathematics.
So, Hillary, why that jumble of anxious emotions, and how do educators help parents reduce that anxiety and sense of mystery?
Well, I think the reality is that many students have inadvertently been positioned as responsible for parents' education about math instruction, and this is pre-COVID, when it really needs to be the school's job to do this. And so I think it's up to educators and leaders this year to establish that proactive communication with families so that they can feel and play that active role that they need to have to be able to support their children.
And what should educators be communicating to parents about math education, Matthew?
Well, it's more than just saying this week we're working on fractions or decimals. Parents want to be helpful. And so often parents, as you said in the open here, they don't necessarily understand the way we're teaching the math. So families need to learn what things should I be doing or what things should I not be doing? Because many times they want to go back to the rote memorization approach, while how they learn math, and that's actually not benefiting their children.
So I want to go back to the rote memorization, Hillary. I understand that. So tell us, why is it so different the way the kids are learning it now?
I know. It feels so different. And honestly, what we're learning right now is not new. So I want to dispel that. A lot of the instruction is what has been happening in other countries that are high performing in mathematics. And we really just need to help parents understand that math instruction changes just like everything else, and to keep up with technology and automation and the need for critical thinkers in our society, the way that we teach math has had to shift in order to address those needs.
1-800-423-8255 to join this conversation. Joel's on the line in Somerville. Hi, Joel.
Hi, how's it going? I don't teach in Somerville. This is where I live. I want to share, I am a teacher, and we tried the experiment of remote learning last year, And basically what we found out is that the risks weren't as severe as we'd worried. We worried there were going to be these huge outbreaks in schools. Didn't really happen. What happens is we get a case, you know, every couple of months, every couple of weeks or so, people quarantine, life goes on. In terms of the kids complying with masks, it's really not a problem. It's easier to get kids to follow the rules than adults. So we're able to do it in a relatively safe way. And then there's just the cost involved of remote learning, which is that, you know, not just the academics. My personal experience as a teacher is the kids suffer terribly in terms of not just the academics and content, but the social, emotional stuff, getting the structure. All these things we saw just had this enormous hidden cost we didn't even account for. So I think in-person learning is really important to follow through,
which we've
learned from an experiment last year. Thanks.
Thanks for that testimonial, Joel. So Joel talks about social, emotional learning there. He did not, it sounds like, feel that was a good experience with virtual learning. I do want to ask, though, was there anything in teaching techniques for teaching math that educators developed or partnered with parents on during virtual learning that can be carried back into the classroom in person now?
That is an excellent question. In fact, last year, my role is the math coordinator within the Chelmsford Public Schools. But last year, I actually spent quite a few months teaching seventh grade math. And I was learning a lot of new skills myself about how to use the technology to support the learning. And at the end of the year, one of the things that we did was said, well, we're going to be going back to in-class learning, but what are some of those things that we learned, some of those apps, some of the technology that we can keep using to support student learning? And there are quite a few things that we can do. In regards to supporting parents, one of the things that we really like to promote is the idea of growth mindset. Within the mathematics field, we look at STEM, science, technology, engineering, they love doing it. And then in math, people are so willing to say, I can't do it or I hate it. So we really want to promote talking to parents as well as students about saying, if you don't have anything good to say about it, let's not say anything at all, because parents are the role models for the kids.
So what else, Hillary, do parents need to do in this partnership? Can parents do in this partnership to support their kids' quantitative learning?
Well, I think most students have started school at this point. So if by the end of the month you have not heard correspondence with your child's teacher about what your child's learning in math throughout the year, and really in particular right now, take the initiative, reach out to your teachers, and let them know that you want to play an active role in your child's math learning. Ask for an overview of the current unit that tells you about the math and specifically gives you the language that you need to be able to talk to your child at home about what they're learning, and get example questions that you can ask your child to support what they're doing.
So, Matthew, let's take this quote-unquote not good at math thing head on. We often hear kids, and we know there is research to suggest girls later in primary school, sort of develop this sense that I can't do math, that my brain doesn't work that way. Take that one head on for us.
Absolutely. I love the way you phrase that question, because within our society, we would never go somewhere and announce to everybody, I don't know how to read or I can't write. But yet if you go somewhere and you say, I don't love math, you'll get high fives from that. And our society accepts that. And we believe, Hillary and I both, that everybody has the ability to learn mathematics. We learn it differently in the sense that we focus on conceptual understanding now more because of all the technologies we have, and less than procedural knowledge in that we're doing that rote memorization. But we believe that everyone has that opportunity to learn math at a high level with the supports that we can offer them within public schools.
So Hillary, go.
I was just going to say, what Matthew's saying is that math is not a gene. It's not a genetic code that we're built with. Everyone can learn math.
So let me ask you then, let's illustrate this conceptual learning idea. So let's take, you know, old school long division, the way we would have learned it.
We still learn that, but we learn that in sixth grade now, rather than learning that in second and third grade like we might have done.
So what's the conceptual learning in second and third grade now that you get instead as a kid?
So now we understand the relationship between multiplication and division, and we understand that they're inverses of one another so that we can use them to help each other. We draw pictures or use concrete tools, things that I can actually touch and play with so that I can develop an understanding of what division even is. That way, when I get to those steps later on in long division, I understand what I'm doing. I'm not just doing a procedure because the teacher told me this is what I need to do.
All right, and just to follow up on that, here's a concrete example that actually just happened with my own son this week, where we were doing a problem, 12 times 4. And instead of having him just memorize it and say, oh, 48, because that's what I memorized, he said, well, I know that 12 is 10 plus 2, so 4 times 10 is 40, and 2 times 4 is 8. And 40 plus 8 is 48. Literally, tears were in my eyes because he truly understood the math as opposed to just memorizing it.
So let's stay with that for a second, Matthew. You just told us something that happened, I'm picturing your kitchen table, right, after dinner. What are some things that families can be doing in the apartment, in the house, after a meal, playing games, helping their kids learn, helping their kids feel confident about learning quantitative subjects?
I'll give you three good examples. Number one, avoiding the dinner topic question of how was your day?
Dun,
because
dun, dun.
It usually ends with good, and that's it. Instead, tell me one thing you learned in math class today, and then find out how you can support the child with that. Second is that we do a lot of reading and promote reading within our houses. Why not try to find some books that have mathematics embedded into it? There are so many great books, Bedtime Math, 12 Ways to Get 11, 17 Kings and 42 Elephants, great books that have the math built into it to support it. And finally, playing games such as, you know, Monopoly, Prime Climb, 24, Payday, that have the mathematics built into it so it becomes part of your family life.
Okay, I have to admit, I now want to know what the 12 ways are to get 11. So you, you have piqued my interest there. So Hillary, talk directly to parents now. Anxiety, well, big change.
Yes, lots of anxiety. Yeah. I hear from parents lately lots of worry about learning loss and that their children are falling behind and how are we going to catch them up. I want you to shift your perspective. You can't lose something that you haven't learned or didn't have. What happened was interrupted learning, and it wasn't just here. It was everywhere. The entire world had interrupted learning. And so your child didn't lose anything. In fact, I bet you can think of lots of things your children gained: persistence, technology skills, other things. If I go to the gym and I work out and then I take a break, or if I work out even less over a small segment of time,
just a few seconds left.
When I get back into the gym, my muscle memory kicks in and allows me to get back where I was with some practice. That's what's going to happen this year. Our muscle memory is going to kick in.
That is super encouraging. And that is Hillary Kreisberg, director of the Center of Mathematical Achievement at Lesley University, along with Matthew Beyranavand, mathematics coordinator for Chelmsford Public Schools. Hillary and Matthew, great to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Absolute Thank pleasure. You. Thank you so much.
As we sigh, close out the summer, we are looking back at some of our favorite conversations from the past year and our live discussion yesterday about the tangible health benefits that we get from trees got us thinking about a segment from Radio Boston's Chris Siderick when he brought us along into the fresh green pine-scented forest surrounding a lake that lays in the shadow of Mount Monadnock. Chris soaked in the natural beauty with author Andrew Krivak, whose newest novel, The Bear, was inspired by the natural setting around Krivak's home in Jaffrey, New Hampshire, at the base of the mountain.
Okay, I just see the summit right up there.
That, yeah.
You see that?
That's Andrew, pointing through the thick gray clouds gliding across the jagged rocky Monadnock summit. You couldn't quite see the top of the mountain from his front yard, but luckily for me, Andrew was kind enough to row us out into the middle of Thorndike Pond to preview our ascent.
And when we go up there, those rocky ledges, you can just see, you'll see the pond, you'll see the roof of the house, and then as you drop down that saddle and head towards the summit, you lose it. You can just see the pond where we are now.
Yeah.
But everything else disappears. Oh. So cool.
I could have floated on the still, tranquil water all day, but we had a long walk ahead of us, and it was time to get started.
Pop that bumper out, which is just push it overboard. There we go. Why don't you get out first?
What had brought me here to climb this mountain with Andrew was an absolute gut punch from his book. A question I just couldn't shake. How do I give my kids what they need to continue their journey, even after I'm no longer here to hold their hands and walk by their side? As Andrew and I began our climb, he told me that despite the big and sometimes heavy themes of the book, the novel was actually born out of a bedtime story.
So that's how it all began.
Yeah.
On the fly. Totally exhausted parent trying to come up with a story.
So. I have no idea what that feels like.
I know you know.
Over time, the story evolved. Andrew changed the main characters from a man and his son to a man and his daughter, but it still didn't feel quite right. And then one day, he was out in the middle of Thorndike Pond feeling like the only person left in the world.
And then I was out fishing one day and just looking around and thinking, what's it going to be like for the last two? And I thought, that's it. It's got to be the last two. That's the crux of the narrative.
After that, the rest of the pieces began to fall into place.
Once I realized it was the last two, I thought theologically it would be really interesting if the creation myth gives us the man first. The other side of that myth would be fitting if a woman were last.
So he's created a story to bookend Adam and Eve. But for Andrew, humans are just one part of that story. Nature, which he calls the first actor, is the real protagonist. And he worries that sometimes people put so much emphasis on progress, our species' steady march forward, that we lose sight of our connection with the natural world.
And then forgetting that we've created a distance with nature.
That we just kind of accept it as the status quo?
Well, it's got to be not only just accepted as status quo and say, oh, isn't that terrible, but really, in some corners, just really thinking this is precisely the way it ought to be. We ought to be as far away from it as possible so that our lives can be better, easier, healthier, you know.
Even the word civilized kind of...
More civilized, exactly. Yeah.
As we got closer to the summit, the trees became thinner and shorter, giving way to the broad, flat boulders that topped the mountain. We made our way out onto an open, rocky ledge at the foot of the summit, a place strikingly similar to one of the most powerful moments in the book, when the man takes the girl to see where her mother is buried.
Behind it was only sky, so that in profile the shape of that summit looked to her, too, like the head of a bear staring into the blue. And off to the side, as though on a shoulder of that head, she saw a cairn of rocks, on top of which was placed a large flat stone. She could feel her sweat cool as the wind pushed against her arms and chest, looked over at her father and pointed to the pile. He nodded, and they made those last strides together.
Those last strides together. So much of the book's power comes from what every parent knows, that someday we'll no longer be here, and our children will have to walk their own paths.
It's not my job to make them anything other than who they are. You know, it's my job not to get in their way. So, I think about my parents as well. I didn't realize this until my father had passed away, that he did a great job of never putting an obstacle in my way. And I am who I am as a result of it.
Sitting there on that rocky ledge, thousands of feet above the pond where we started, I thought about how, as a father of two boys, I feel that constant tension between this responsibility to prepare them to continue on after I'm gone, and at the same time, an overwhelming desire to shelter and protect them from a world that can be harsh and ugly. I asked Andrew how he thought about that struggle as a father himself, as he was writing the story.
Yeah, great question. I thought about it a lot, pretty much every time I sat down to write on the page. When the man is at the beach, and he's looking out at the horizon, and he's saying to no one, to everything and nothing, she's not ready yet. It's that tension of, I know I'm going to go, and she'll never be ready, as far as I'm concerned. But he can't write her story for her.
As we began our descent, I asked Andrew, you wrote this book before the pandemic. If you were writing it today, would you change anything? And he surprised me when he said, no.
It's not about climate change. It's not about pandemics. It's not about human extinction. It's about a man who's heard stories, telling stories to his daughter, who finds a way to keep listening to stories and finds a way in which stories are told in ways other than her father told her.
You said kind of early on in the trail that, you know, that in this moment we're living, that someone will tell this story someday.
Yeah.
What do you think that's going to look like?
Yeah. I don't know. And that's funny. We're, you know, they talk about a beginning, a middle, and an end of story. We're right in the middle.
Yeah.
And who knows how the end goes? Someone's got to tell it. But I think about that a lot. And I also think that it's not our time yet to tell it to the end. Our time is now to live in it. We are in the middle.
Yeah.
And that's scary, exciting, beautiful, real, all those things.
Andrew sees humanity as part of a middle, too. The Earth was here long before us, and it will outlast us. Back on the shore of Thorndike Pond, where we started our journey, Andrew read an excerpt from the end of his story, a bear's reflection on the world after the last human has left this great green earth.
It had been night a long time when he emerged from the trees and lumbered into the clearing beneath a waning moon. He waded into the lake, drank, and came out, sat in the high grass and looked up at the stars. He felt the fatigue of his task as though he had come to a place where end and beginning were the same. And in the time he'd spent on that mountain, everything had changed. He lifted his ears to listen and heard nothing. No steps of animals, no whisper of trees, no snap of insects, no lapping waves. A silence as cold and strange to him as winter. He wondered how long he had been sitting there, if for just a moment the earth stood still, when the leaves of the forest began to rustle and the ghostly wail of a loon floated across the surface of the water. He rose and stretched and turned so that the great bear was over his right shoulder. Then he set out, moving west along the shore, the sky beginning to pale behind him, like the world itself being born.
So that's, if you're talking about the ending, the end of humanity, but it's almost happy.
Well, yeah. I think what I was imagining was a way in which we could think about the existence of humanity as something that's part of stories. The flesh, as it were, dies. There are no more humans. But the story of humans is captured and lives on in here, in nature, in the animals, in the trees, in the very, you know, very water we've just been over. And to me, that seemed okay. You know, maybe that's what we need to think about if there's a sense of what's the climate mean to us? What does the environment mean to us? We should sort of let go of the hubris that we are the beginning and the end, and just think of ourselves as part of the middle.
That, Radio Boston's Chris Siderick, speaking with author Andrew Krivak about Krivak's newest novel, The Bear. Hey, we'll be back on air at 7. Don't miss it. WBUR and Radio Boston partnering with the Boston Globe, WCVB Channel 5, and the John W. McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston for a one-hour virtual debate live from WBUR City Space. All five major candidates are going to be there. You can find out more at wbur.org/events. But for now, that's our show. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening.